Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Stocks are down in the U.S. Apple, and we hitting the climax top. The VIX surges. And our guest today, Das, talking all about Europe and everything surrounding the current situation. All this and much more on episode number 250 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, here we are. It's February 13th, the week of February 13th, 2012, and lots to talk about because there's lots going on around the world. Once again, seems like the calm that was prevalent over the last several weeks is really kind of getting a little bit, well, long in the tooth with all the things that are happening in Europe and the bringing together of all the bailouts for Greece. And then on top of that, we have what's happening in the Middle East. And boy, there's just a lot of things that are bubbling under the surface right now. Yeah, earnings season has been pretty good. And in fact, we have seen the continuation of the bear market just disintegrate. Or better said, the bull market just continued to elevate. And a lot of people who were on the other side of the coin where they're saying, hey, you know what? This is just a bear market bounce or it's just a small rally in between. You know what? They've capitulated. In fact, funny as it may seem, longtime bear John C. Dvorak on DH Unplugged last week said that he was going to buy some positions on the long side. And I said, uh-oh, what does that mean? You're capitulating, John. And he said, well, maybe a little bit. And we actually saw things like Nouriel Roubini, who is the, I guess, talk about the bears. He is the bear of all bears, right? He's the guy that thinks that the world is ending and is never going to recover. At least that's what his talk and his walk has been for some time. He's even saying that he's bullish. In fact, there was, this is kind of funny. There was a recent tweet, I guess it was, from Doug Kass, money manager and hedge fund manager. And he said, sell everything. Absolutely sell everything. Why? Because Roubini is bullish. So that's kind of interesting, I thought. And also that that was published in the Wall Street Journal. And there's been some discussion about getting close to the top of the range. And all these things are coming together and spooking a lot of players out there. We saw the VIX hit a low and then just ramp up. We'll talk about that in a second. Throughout the week last week. And we also saw the bearish sentiment drop dramatically, or better said, the bullish sentiment increase dramatically. Put-to-call ratio, short interest, all these things are interesting signs and somewhat of a contrarian indicator. Not absolute, because things tend to move much further in any given direction than should be. So we're gonna kind of keep that on the surface and edge around that a little bit today. And also talk about some of the other things that I think are really important. Let's talk about the fact that it was the worst week, not saying much, the worst week for stocks of 2012. I think it was 5 weeks or so of up moves of the market have just dissipated. And, the drawdown last week really wasn't a big deal. You know, somewhere around 0.5% for the S&P and 0.8% for the NYSE and the NASDAQ kind of just went down a little bit. But the thing was that the mood changed somewhat around Wednesday. Even though markets were moving higher on Wednesday into Thursday, the VIX started to move up a little bit. And the undercurrent of what was happening in Europe particularly was really concerning. And on top of that, we added the big concern about what's happening in Iran, which I got to tell you something. You know, lunacy just doesn't seem to be in any short supply these days, whether it's North Korea, whether it's Iran and parts of the Middle East, and obviously the economic situation and the commentary throughout Europe is really just enough to make you want to just, you know, kind of say, what in the world are people thinking? What are these smart people, not all of them, but what are some of these smart people thinking? You have a nuclear Iran these days. Israel is just beside themselves. And a lot of talk about maybe even a first strike, which doesn't seem logical. Not in Israel's, not something they've done in the past and not something they've really held on to. It's something, a first strike. They've been more of a defensive, been more of a, coming out and saying, hey, don't even get near that, and being very, very bold in their statements. But first strike, I don't know. But there's going to be sanctions if Iran continues this discussion. And on top of that, we see Syria utilizing individuals, human beings, as shields in their tank brigades. And just really, just again, this whole eruption of nonsense throughout the world is become a little bit more concerning. But I think that the major thing that we need to look at is that towards the end of the week, there was a bit of climax top for things like Apple. Now, whether you think that was or not, just simply look at the chart. We posted a discussion of this last week on Thursday, the end of Thursday, and said, you know what, look at the pattern of Apple. The recent parabolic move of Apple after there was the announcement of their earnings, and then on top of that, the potential for an iPhone 5, and then the iPad 3, and now an Apple TV. Look at how that stock moved. It's like everybody said, finally, okay, fine. I'm gonna buy it. It's not pulling back. The stock, the company is doing really well. There's nothing wrong. They're firing on all cylinders. It doesn't seem like any kind of missteps on the economic global situation is going to cause any kind of concern for Apple, because everybody has desire to own something Apple. So when you look at what happened, though, again, it doesn't matter if the name is Apple, or if it's IBM, or if it's AT&T, or I don't care. Pick your name of your stock and put a symbol in there and look at the chart of Apple, where you see that parabolic move, those gap ups, those dramatic long stretches of candles that just go right to the roof after a nice run. It is usually a near turn top of the stock. That doesn't mean Apple's going to roll over and be, just sold like crazy over the next several weeks or months. No. But let's be smart about this. Does it mean that Apple will continue to move higher on a consistent basis like it's doing now? Time and time again, when we've seen stock patterns like this, these climax tops, these, look at these as these parabolic moves, it usually is a sign that there is a last gasp of people getting into the stock, those last players that are going to be buying the positions. And that's never a good sign. We're close to $500 per share on Apple. Many targets are in the $500 range, even close to $600. And by the way, we own Apple. I love Apple. Apple's great. The company's great. There's nothing negative I'm saying about this. But all I'm saying is that consider maybe take a little bit off the table, a little bit of the profits off the table. We sold about 20% of our position last week at the end of Thursday towards about the 494 area on Apple. And we're thinking that, right now it needs a little bit of a pause. They say the pause that refreshes. We need a little bit of a pause, a little bit of a drawback. And if you look at the pattern right now, it's very classically forming into a climax top, evening star, whatever you want to actually look at it. And I know there's a lot of people out there that love Apple and all and would never think of selling any shares. But, it looks like just a point that we may see a little pullback and an opportunity to buy back again in the future. So again, I'm not saying that Apple's going to roll over here. I'm not saying this is the end of the run for Apple forever. No. What I'm saying, though, is that the move recently was a little bit outsized and a little bit disproportional to what it was, what it should have been. So take a look at that. We wrote about that last week on thedisciplinedinvestor.com, and there's a whole piece on there talking about note to clients, what's going on with Apple. Just look at that. I just want you to consider it, if nothing else, from an educational standpoint. Whether it plays out or not, we'll follow up with it. We'll talk about it. We'll see what happens. But there's nothing wrong with taking some profit. There's nothing wrong with cashing in a little bit of your gains. And they say that nobody ever went bankrupt taking a profit. So just consider that as something. Now the VIX, let's talk about what happened there. The VIX last week was getting to a point of showing, kind of like never-ending movement down, like there's no panic, no concern, no fear, nothing that anybody is concerned about at all with the markets. Complacency is really what it was. We got into a situation where there was this complacency because every time the markets would go down, there'd be this scoop up, this buying of it. And by the end of the day, it would be even or a little bit up, in fact. You see this gap down in the morning of the futures, and then towards the afternoon, it would just rise up and move higher and end the day like nothing ever happened. And, of course, with that, the VIX would continue to move down. But something happened again. Something happened towards Thursday. Now, what was it? Well, was it the fact that Greece was going to possibly default and they're putting up a big stink about all the rules and things that are going on and delay, and Germany saying, hey, guys, get your act together or we're not giving you any more money? Or was it the Iran situation? Was it the CPI in China coming in a little bit hot, 4.5 versus 4? It could be a lot of different things. Was it the end of the earnings season? Was it concern about Cisco? You know what? Whatever it was, even though the market was moving higher on Thursday into the close, the VIX was also moving higher as well. Now, one of the things you need to be aware of is that once again, what we have here is a disproportional amount of players on the short side of the VIX. So you have options players that are really in the short side of the VIX transaction. They either sold the calls, or they, in fact, some of them bought puts. So what happened here is that as we started to see a little bit of a move higher, whether or not it was because of any of the reasons we discussed or because of it just became a time to take some profits, all of a sudden there was the beginnings on Thursday afternoon into the close, and then clearly on Friday of a short squeeze. And that short squeeze was really exacerbated by the fact that when Friday the market started to roll down and not recover, what happened? That all of a sudden there was a big rise in the VIX because all of a sudden you had people not only fearing what was going on over the weekend and the potential default of Greece, but then you had, on top of that, the reality that a lot of these short players were starting to cover their positions, and it just went ballistic. For the week, the VIX was actually up about 20% or so. TVIX, which is one of the two times of the VIX, the ETF that we talked about before, which doesn't always play very nicely. It's a different measure of the VIX. It's a short-term VIX. It has some inherent problems like UNG does. So it's really for short-term, whether it's intraday or few days, a week or so, 2 weeks, 3 weeks max. It went up 35% for the week, which is pretty dramatic. And in fact, at one point on Friday, it was up 25%. It came back to be up about 15% or so on Friday. But we actually went in and sold some of the position as it was way up on the rise in the latter part of the afternoon on Friday and took our position down. And we'll, in fact, go back and invest in it as we see, if we see it, actually turn around and start moving in the other direction. Because right now, that move, again, was outsized for the day. The 25% move towards the end was clearly a squeeze, a short covering, whatever you want to call it, but it was outsized and disproportional. Again, an intraday climax top of the intraday movement. So last week, we talked about this at length. I want you to, if you haven't done so already, go back and listen to last week's episode as well as download the spreadsheet that shows all of the different VIX products that are available that you can actually use. And right now, with the concern rising and the VIX starting to turn around here, you look at that as a way to either protect the portfolio or to actually invest in something for a short-term trade for profit. Either way, seems to work. So when we look at that whole environment of the risk factors and the fear gauge and the concern, which we thought that, hey, it's just going to drop off to nothing. I mean, we're talking about a 17 and change was the VIX during the week and ended up at 21, just about 21. That's a big move for the week. 11% move just on Friday. So just as we see climax tops on Apple, you know, maybe that was an intraday climax top on the VIX. And in fact, it was rolled back down and took off about, I think about 5% from the top or so. Now, I wanted to just briefly talk about some of the economics and things that are happening in the upcoming week that you need to be aware of. We saw that, first of all, on Friday, the Michigan sentiment, the preliminary survey for the University of Michigan for February came out a little bit soft. And we also saw that inventories in factories, wholesale inventories, were a little bit higher than anticipated, which means that the The slowdown in manufacturing will probably follow just ever so slightly because there's not going to be a need to continue to fill inventories if they're not being sold off. We've talked about that whole inventory cycle and what happens when you see inventories rising. It's a good sign because manufacturing before that had really been working very nicely. But on top of that, you have to say, well, what happens when inventories start to all of a sudden get disproportionately large, oversized, and growing? What you have is the opposite that's going to happen, that manufacturing is going to slow down a bit because you have to get rid of that inventory first. You don't want to hold on to that inventory and then have to sell it off at lower prices. So right now, what we're looking at is the potential for a little bit of a slowdown. I think that the GDP numbers that we saw this quarter are probably the highest we're going to see in a couple of quarters, even though things look a lot better right now. And then, so next week we have coming up retail sales. We also have the Fed notes and the meeting minutes, if you will, from the last meeting. So next week isn't really a full week of economics. Some earnings coming out, they're important. I think the focus is going to be back on Europe again because Wednesday is this deadline, or at least another deadline, once again, that will probably be either missed or delayed or postponed for Greece to come up with something because they want to get this $170 billion bailout at this point. Now, George Soros has been all over Merkel, Angela Merkel, saying, hey, you know what? This is the wrong prescription for anything when it comes to Greece. When you're going to have a country that you're imposing this level of austerity on and at the same time trying to figure out a way to have growth and to give them bonds and loans at these high prices, there is no way that they're going to come out of this. You need growth to come out of this. Well, I agree with that. At the same time, I disagree with that. You have to have austerity from the government side where they cut back on spending, right? Because, you know, what's gotten them in the big trouble has been the incredible amount of spending they did, disregarding the fact that one day they'll have to pay it back. On the other hand, I also agree that you can't have severe austerity that is imposed on a populace that is going to have negative growth and lower tax receipts. And not only that, heavy rioting and strikes that are like what's going on right now in Greece. And finally, I agree you can't have a default or bankruptcy of Greece because that will just spill over to the rest of the European region and just pretty much shut down the entire banking system. Even though we saw last week and the week before and throughout 2012, a much better situation when it comes to the risk levels of all the different gauges that we look at throughout the year, the LIBOR, the Euro 3-month basis swap, CDS rates, all of those have shown much better numbers. But you know what? Let's leave more of that to our discussion with Das. He's going to be the one that has all the answers when it comes to many of these questions. I have a long list of questions that I really want to ask him and things that I want to get into with regard to Europe and all that. Let's see what else I had on my list. I had a couple other things. Oh, Tweet Week is officially over. I hope you enjoyed that. I got some great emails from people who picked up a few of those positions. And you can continue following us where we put some things out on Trigger Trading. That's over at, well, just go over to Twitter and just sign up for either Andrew Horowitz or Trigger Trading, and you'll continue to get some of that and find out more about what's going on with not only our alert products that we have coming out, as well as this whole new earnings reports. Really cool. Really, really cool stuff. You'll see what's happening with that. Pre-earnings reports that will give you some idea of how to play the trade moving forward and really how to analyze what is meant by the various earnings numbers. You've probably seen headlines earning numbers that a company beat or missed, and then all of a sudden the stock does exactly opposite of what you thought it would do moving forward. So we're going to have that available for you. Also mentioned that we did take some profits on last week on Apple, on Mercado Libre, Albemarle, the Russian ETF we actually moved out of last week. And we took a little position off of NetEase last week as well. We kind of cut that back. And also, we are still holding our natural gas position and pretty happy with it, thinking that there is going to be the continuation of many companies shutting down their U.S.-based, we'll call it, production, just like Chesapeake did and a couple companies did last week in order to really stabilize the price of natural gas. Finally, I'll mention that I had a discussion with Jonathan Liu of Bloomberg. One of the things that happened over the weekend was that China You know, last week, China, one of the townships in China came out with a commentary that they're going to relax some of the requirements to buy a house, build a house, own a house there and property. And markets took that pretty well as a sign that there's going to be some relaxation in that area. Well, a day later, China said, you know what? You need to revisit this. We're not letting you do this. So what you're seeing is this competition and the desire by the local authorities versus the federal government, if you will, or China as a whole. And China is clearly still going to try their best to really hold back and to really just not do anything with in terms of property because they don't want it to, you know, continue getting out of hand. So anyway, you got to watch the news on China because there's a lot of back and forth going on there. And that whole region is in very much in flux right now when it comes to the economics because things are slowing down and they get a lot of business from Europe. So with that, let's just briefly talk about this fact that, you know, as you know, you do know that we are sponsored by GoToMeeting. And GoToMeeting has a new product, which is very easy to use. I've mentioned it before. It's called GoToMeeting with HD Faces because now you're able to actually communicate and see the people you're talking to at the same time. Because, you know, there's nothing like a sales meeting where you can actually have much more of a, well, particularly when we're talking about a virtual sales meeting, when you can have much more interaction with someone and see what their basic facial expressions are, what their body language is, and you can find out a little bit more about, you know, what they're thinking on an eye-to-eye basis. So when you're collaborating and you're doing things in real time, now you're able to actually feel very connected. So GoToMeeting is really easy to use. You know that already. And I encourage you to use it. It is a great tool in your arsenal if you're just doing meetings or if you want to use this new GoToMeeting HD Faces. I encourage you to check it out. You get a 30-day free total subscription to it. And all you have to do is go to GoToMeeting.com, click on the Try It Free button, and use the promo code podcast. Make sure to use that promo code podcast and you get 30 free days of GoToMeeting and now this HD Faces. Pretty cool stuff. So how about we segue into our discussion about all things Europe and all things about the world with our good friend Das. And you asked for it? Not only once, twice, three times. Lots of email, as I mentioned, has come in to bring back Das. The one, the only, the beloved Das, all the way from down under in Australia, to talk about a variety of different things that he is very knowledgeable with. And I thought we would kind of cover a lot of that today because a lot of things are coming to a head. Hello, my friend.
I'm very flattered that your listeners want me back.
You know, they want you. I told you this before. They want you more than they want me.
No, that's not true. Andrew, that's not true. That's not true. And let's stop all this mutual admiration society stuff. Your listeners will be bored to tears.
Yeah, I hear you. But you're looking very good lately.
Thank you.
And you're getting around. I see a lot of things that you're writing and all that. Let's talk. There's obviously a lot of people from our show know you as talking about and the predictor of a lot of things bad in Europe. We'll talk about that. I think it's important because, you know, over the last several weeks, as a matter of fact, I think you'd agree with this. The clock struck 12, December 31st.
Yep.
And everybody decided, well, that was last year. Everything is fine this year.
I think it's called a January effect.
It's more than that. It's like a hallucination.
I think it's probably right. I think people are smoking something. All I want to know is, where can I get some?
Yeah, no, not Amsterdam. They're cutting that down. So what's going on? I mean, you know, I know that we had this backdoor bailout of at least $90 billion by the U.S., and we saw a lot of the liquidity issues go away. We saw that the LTRO is going on with money coming in. We see that the fascinating thing about the government is giving money to the banks. The banks are then giving it back to the government, which I don't understand that. You could explain that a little bit. And are things better a little bit?
Well, I think there's been some temporary steps taken, particularly by the European Central Bank, which has obviously taken away some immediate liquidity risk. And the strategy, I have a name for this. This is called the Mediterranean economics, or the other one I call it is Sarkonomics, after Nicolas Sarkozy. Because he gave an amazing speech, because when everybody was talking about the problems of the European sovereigns funding themselves, he said, there is no problem. The ECB will give them money at 1%. They will take the money and go and buy government bonds at 6%. And he said, I can't tell you, I don't have to tell you, that that's a good economic decision. And that's the basic strategy in Europe, in the short run anyway. So they've sort of killed two birds with one stone. The European Central Bank will pump money in, and essentially the banks are therefore relieved of their liquidity pressure, and they will keep buying government bonds, which means the governments don't have a problem in issuing the debt. Now, this doesn't fix a lot of problems, and it creates new ones. Let's look at the problems it doesn't fix. It doesn't address the fundamental issue of the debt levels, and it doesn't address the fundamental question of the cost of financing. Because, as you know, leaving aside the basket case of Greece and Portugal, if you look at Spain and Italy, their bond yields are still unsustainably high, 5 and near 6%. And, you know, what we know is if they keep funding at 5 or 6%, they'll just go bankrupt pretty much because of the volume of debt they have. So basically that hasn't been fixed. But what we are doing is now doing a Hail Mary pass and hoping somehow down the track growth will come back and everything will be hunky-dory. That's the basic strategy. But there's some technical problems with what the ECB is doing. The first thing is, it is sort of, it's not quite what Ben Bernanke is doing, but it is sort of quantitative easing, because the money that's going in to the banking system, theoretically the ECB is supposed to go and issue bonds on the other side in sort of what's known as sterilization, though it's too painful to call it sterilization.
No kidding.
Yes, it sounds like a snip in the wrong places of your anatomy, so I just don't like it. But they're not sterilizing now. I've been trying to work out that basically whether there is some sterilization going on, but they don't seem to be. So basically, they are expanding liquidity. The second problem, that's not a problem in the first place, because that's what everybody's been urging them to do. But that doesn't fix the problem. We all know that. But the two other issues which have come out is very interesting. One is the ECB is not lending them the money without collateral. So basically, the banks have to stump up collateral, and that usually used to be government bonds, great quality assets like Italian government and Spanish government bonds. But they still have to do that. And the problem for the banks is that they have a limited amount of this collateral, and not all the right banks have the collateral. And in trying to create the collateral, what they're doing is basically cutting down on normal lending. So basically, they can't lend. And essentially, what is happening is we're getting a massive liquidity contraction to real businesses. And, you know, Andrew, at the end of the day, you know, the real businesses create effectively jobs and so forth. So there's this liquidity contraction going on. The second issue is that this is for 3 years. And everybody who has any common sense is asking the question, well, this is all great, but what happens when the 3 years is up? And everybody's going, well, that's 3 years away. So we've sort of bought a bit of time. But the other fundamental problem here is the banking system and also Germany. And the banking system problem is they need capital. And the problem is that they're not going to get it. I mean, the great example of that was the Italian bank UniCredito, which did a rights offering to its shareholders, and the shares fell by 43%.
Yeah, that was ugly.
That was ugly. So UniCredito is now known as UniDebito. So basically, nobody wants to go out and basically lend money simply because they're trying to shrink their balance sheet to recapitalize themselves in this way. And that's a problem that the ECB hasn't dealt with. And the ECB, and you've got to understand Europe to some part, you know, the right hand doesn't know what the left hand is doing. The ECB is doing all of this, and the European Banking Authority, which is responsible for regulating banks, is supposed to vet all these plans for raising capital that the banks have. And they've said the plans aren't sufficient, because the banks have put flaky things like, let's change the risk weighting of assets, let's basically go out and say we're going to sell these assets. And these guys are saying, well, no, you know, you haven't given us a plan which is credible. But the ECB is saying, ignore that. Let them keep lending to any extent possible to keep the economy going. So there's a lot of to and fro on that. And the last issue is a really ugly one, which is Germany. Now, Germany is in serious trouble, and people don't seem to realize it. Germany is out just on the guarantees to all these bailouts, 211 billion euros. Now, they haven't funded that because these are all contingencies. But the big problem for them is the current account deficits of the weaker countries in Europe is being funded by Germany through the Bundesbank. And this is the famous target two system, which is like a settlement system between central banks. Germany is owed 500 billion euros. Now, if you total that, that's about 711 billion euros. And the problem with the 500 is that's real money because they've actually lent it. And the Bundesbank has a serious problem now. When you started the crisis, they had about 270 billion euros worth of securities, like government bonds and so forth. They've now got 20 because they've sold that to fund all the other countries. Now, the only assets they have left is this 20 billion of securities and 150 billion of gold. Now, there's talk that they're going to have to sell the gold. And in Germany, if the Bundesbank sells gold, that is going to lead to the German equivalent of the French Revolution.
Mm.
And that's going to be a huge issue. This is being sort of hidden because the German politicians don't want to discuss this with anybody because it's just so emotive. And the other problem is the way the Bundesbank is funding this is they have actually borrowed from the German banking system. They've actually borrowed almost 230 billion euros. And this is very unusual because usually the banks borrow from the central bank. It's actually now the other way around. The Bundesbank is borrowing from the German banks. It's just a weird situation. So there are all these things that are not being resolved. So we're doing the European version of the American game, extend and pretend, and throw a few Hail Mary passes and hope it works. So, and there's, of course, the issue of Greece.
Yeah, the Greece. Now, there's a couple of things, though. You mentioned a lot of things there. And here's a couple of questions I have. In terms of the lending, so you mentioned that the ECB is giving money to the various sovereigns, and the sovereigns are then giving it back. The sovereigns, it's this round thing, you know, the round robin.
Money's just going around.
Right, where they're borrowing it at 1% and then getting 6%. But here's the problem. Number one is that when you're lending it to the sovereigns, it's not risk-free in theory, you know?
Well, they used to be. It's no longer.
Right. Well, it's no longer. Right. But at the same time now, what's going on in Greece is that the ECB is saying, hey, we're going to strike a deal. You guys that are private investors in the bonds are going to take a 70% haircut that is derived by this whole calculation of the, they're going to take a longer bond at a less interest rate. But the ECB is going to get all the money back that they invested, so they're not going to take a haircut at all. That's how the whole thing has to be structured in order for them to continue investing. But at the same time, who in their right minds as an investor, whether you're a hedge fund or another government, would put money into a sovereign knowing that they're going to do everything they can not to create a CDS default titling, and then at the same time not take any haircuts themselves? I mean, it's very, I hate to say this word, but it's very unfair. And it is not only unfair, it's creating a very concerning environment in that I don't know why anyone would want to put their money with this in such a, it's almost a twisted mafioso style lending deal.
Well, you're absolutely correct, because there's now a phrase which has come into the vocabulary. It's called, we're going to live in an era of financial repression.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have money, the governments are going to take it away.
That's exactly what's happening.
That's exactly what's happening. But, you know, the thing about the ECB that you're talking about in the Greek negotiations is actually very crucial, because everybody's talking about the negotiations between Greece and its lenders. But I find that quite, credulous, because the real discussions here are between the ECB, the International Monetary Fund, the European Union, and the lenders. Greece is a bystander because it's irrelevant to Greece. And let me explain why it's irrelevant.
Mm.
The first thing is the money that's going to come in isn't going to go to Greece. And it's basically going to go to the lenders.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, overnight, the Germans confirmed this. The Germans and the French are quite hilarious at the moment. They actually said, we don't trust Greece. Absolutely. And basically, they said, well, when we release the funds, it's not going to go to Greece. It's going to go into an escrow account, and it'll go directly back to the lenders. I said, well, why don't we just dispense with all pretense, write off all this debt, and the French and the Germans can just give the money to their banks, who are the real problem here.
Mm-hmm.
That's the first issue. The second issue is that these discussions have nothing to do with, effectively, the Greek debt. The real problem here is they have to write that off. We all know that. But the ECB is out, and they won't even be truthful about it, how much they're out to Greece, but the market estimates are between 40 and 80 billion euros. The ECB has 5 billion in capital. So if they take a haircut, they will need to be recapitalized. As I said, forget about the European banking system. The first person you'd have to recapitalize is the European Central Bank. And so they don't want to do that, and the IMF, on the loans that they've made for their own rules, have to have priority. So this discussion is now surreal, because the discussion should be about how we get the Greek debt down to a manageable level so they have some chance of growing so they can pay back whatever it is that they're left with. But instead of that, the discussion is about how do we insulate the ECB and the IMF. And the banks, to some extent, are sort of also bystanders because they know. I mean, the last deal that was cut, the 50% haircut, was cut, as I understand it. The European Union just walked into the room and told the banks this is what it was going to be, and if they didn't like it, well, that was bad luck.
Yeah, no, that's exactly what happened from every account.
Exactly. And now, of course, the banks are learning that it's the 50% is going to become 70% plus. And everybody knows now, and this is the really important thing about Greece in my judgment, is that everybody knows this is basically the trial run for the bigger ones that are coming,
mm-hmm.
which is Portugal.
Portugal
coming.
Next, right, yeah.
And then Spain is coming, and then Italy is coming.
So let me interrupt you, because there's something I still don't understand. Are you saying to me that when it comes to the amount of money that has been lent out to Greece and how much everybody's in the pocket for, it's less than the next tranche, which is supposed to be paid, about $140 billion? And by the way, if you took all of Greece's debt away, just magically disappeared, just gone. My impression is they'd still have major financial problems.
Oh, look, this is not going to fix it, which is why I find all these market focus on this negotiation to be hilarious. If they agree, let's assume they agree and they do a haircut, there'll be a relief rally. But the problem is we're going to be back at this table within 3 months.
Right.
Because there's no way that they can actually sustain the debt. Because remember that all the magic around here is let's get the debt down to 120% of GDP.
Mm-hmm.
That's nonsense, because basically they can't even sustain that. And then just think about some of the things that will happen. They'll do the deal. The International Institute of Finance, which represents the banks and investors, only really represent roughly about 50% of the lenders. So there's no guarantee that everybody else will agree. And basically there's a very good chance that you'll get protracted litigation. And this is, you love this, Andrew, the hedge funds, which own some of the distressed Greek debt, are going to take the European Union to, believe it or not, the European Court of Human Rights, because apparently the Greeks and the European Union have violated the hedge fund's human rights.
Mm.
So, yeah, basically, this is not going to stop. And the other problem here is that even if you get an agreement, which is tangible, and you may not, we know that, is we know that the Greeks, with all these cuts and so forth, the economy is going to shrink, their budget deficit is going to blow out. There's no way anything's going to happen, and then there's the social unrest. I mean, everybody's going to go on strike. And I can just see what's going to happen. The Greek public sector unions aren't stupid. They're going to stop tax collections, because that's the way you really hurt everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And so basically nothing is going to improve. So we're just going to keep coming back to this, and that's the real issue. And I think the investor community, in a perverse way, is sort of trying to put their heads in the sand like an ostrich and just ignore that, because it's not going to happen. And in the meantime, Portugal is on the slippery slope. And, you know, everybody's saying to me, you know, Mario Monti is doing a great job. I said, Mario Monti hasn't done anything. He just passed a bunch of legislation. Now, whether anything happens or not, we'll have to wait and see in 12 months' time.
And whether or not they're going to be held to it, that's another issue, because so far,
absolutely,
you know, Greece hasn't been held to the fire. I mean, the only time I've seen anything is when Germany recently said, hey, you know what? I don't think you're going to get your money because you didn't hold up your end of the bargain.
Absolutely.
That's the only time. And we know that basically Greece is holding, in my opinion, they're holding all the cards. They're basically checkmating, because if they say they don't like the deal and don't want to do the deal, that's just not acceptable, because a deal has to be done in order to save everybody else.
Absolutely. This is the Keynes' famous theorem of, you know, if you lend £100 to somebody, then he has a problem. If you lend him £1 million, you're the one with the problem.
Right.
And that's exactly what's happened here. And you're absolutely correct. The Greeks actually are playing this much better than most people give them credit for, because they know they want to get to the brink. They want to get as close to March 20th when the $14.5 billion bond matures, because then they will have even more power,
mm-hmm.
because they can threaten to bring the whole shooting match down.
But the markets are now... Overall, there's two different markets. We're talking about fixed income markets, and we're talking about equity markets around the world. First of all, equity markets are interesting because there was a lot of concern that the European situation was going to really put a damper on worldwide growth, or at least, you know, in a significant way. Now, mind you, we could say, hey, a lot of that was priced in, and some of that's not happening. The economic surprise in the U.S. are pretty good. China's still having some problems. They were just knocked down on their growth forecast, and there was some discussion about how about 4 points will be taken off their overall growth in the event that there is a continuation of a recession over in Europe. But the U.S., I mean, you got to admit, the U.S. is not doing so terribly, I mean, in terms of some of the economics.
Absolutely. And I think the big thing about the situation in the United States is somebody asked me this yesterday, and I said the best thing that the United States has going for it is it's not Europe.
Yeah,
and that's basically the first thing. So money is actually flowing back. But there's some other things about the United States economy which I think is very important. One is it's not as dependent on trade as, say, Europe is. Because Europe's much more open and much more reliant on trade, both within Europe but also outside of Europe. So the U.S. to some extent can hunker down, and they've got other things going for it. They had the crisis first.
Right.
And I think people underestimate how important it was to have the crisis first.
By the way, I think that is great that you're mentioning this, because I think it's almost – this is I haven't talked to you about this, but I think this is so key to all of this, is that we did it first.
Absolutely. And you managed – and whatever anybody says about the United States, what Paulson – and you can judge Paulson whichever way you like – what he, Geithner and Bernanke and all of those people did was ram the banks to recapitalize. They were just basically shanghaied into that. And that was very useful. The banks didn't think they needed capital, but they were forced to take it. And they managed to clean up their balance sheets. And this is a temperamental difference between the Europeans and the American psyche. The Americans admitted that it was a problem. They want to clean the decks and go on. The Europeans never admit they have a problem. They just keep storing it up for tomorrow. And that's the big problem. So the United States has cleared its deck to some degree. Now, the other thing which is very important is that you have a weaker U.S. dollar. If you look at the trade-weighted basket, it's weaker, and that certainly helped. And also, the other interesting thing is that many of the U.S. industries which are doing well are actually very, very much sort of state-of-the-art technology type of industries, defense industries, and there's going to be demand for their products. So they've done very well. Now, on the negative side, is despite the very good employment number, it's a bit exaggerated. And I think to his credit, Chairman Bernanke actually said that he didn't take a lot of notice of that one number because obviously employment continues to be weak. But the good thing is you are getting some employment growth. And so I see the U.S. being sort of a low-growth environment. And, you know, I don't think it's that bad in this world to be growing at 0-2. It's, you know, I don't think Europe's going to grow. I mean, Italy, I think, is going to shrink by 2.5%. And the basket case, they're going to shrink by, you know, 5% this year, whereas the United States is going to grow. The thing you've got to be careful about, I think, with the United States is not to get too carried away, because there'll be a couple of headwinds. One is euro's fallen by about 10 big figures in about 3 months, which is about 12%. And the question in my mind is, how does that affect essentially U.S. exports? We'll wait and see. The second interesting thing is that if you actually look at the overseas earnings of the American companies, they're obviously going to be whacked by the stronger dollar. But the other big thing that the United States has going for it, which counterbalances that, is the Fed's going to be very accommodative.
Yeah, very.
So I see, you know, I don't see this fantastic double dip that some of the people seem screaming about. But I see slow growth. It won't come back quickly, but it's not going to fall off the edge of a cliff unless something that we don't know about is going to happen.
Right.
But the other thing I think is important is the corporate balance sheets are not looking bad. Earnings are patchy. I don't think earnings are as great as people are making out. But I don't think they're actually that bad.
No, I agree. And revenues are a little bit – I would say if you would look at revenues and earnings and you separate those two and you look at, okay, well, what's happening with the earnings and all that, I think that a lot of the earnings beats recently were because a lot of the analysts, who, by the way, are just pathetic these days. Economists and analysts are so far off, it's not funny. And maybe one day we'll figure out why that is. I don't think there's a conspiracy. I just think there's the data with the government's involvement is so obscured that it's very difficult for anybody to get a handle on this. But they're just way, way off. Anyway, the EPS is coming in, you know, okay. And that's, of course, because a couple things. It's doing reasonably, and the beats are good. But also because they were taken down so dramatically over the last several months. Revenues, on the other hand, have not been as exciting in the U.S.
No, and I think this is the point that I think we discussed last year. What we're seeing is anybody who's worked for a company will know that during boom times, you build up a lot of fat. And so during the boom, we built up a lot of fat. And the companies, to be very, very fair to the company management, they cut costs. And they cut costs very aggressively. And so we're getting the cost benefits. You got low interest rates, which don't hurt, because if your cost of capital is close, at least debt capital is close to zero, that can't actually hurt you very much. So all of that's helped enormously. The big, big problem for them at the moment, I think you're correct, is the revenue. And the revenue line, I think, is weak and will continue to be weak. And ultimately, and this is where the valuation gets tricky, the cost benefits are all in. The revenue, if it doesn't improve over, say, the next 2 years, let's pick a 2-year, 24-month horizon, and I don't think the revenues are going to improve that much or that dramatically, then, you know, if you look at GDP growth and stock prices, there's a very strong correlation between the two. And that's where you've just got to be a little bit careful in terms of taking value positions, because the leverage is going to be lower, growth is going to be lower. Are these stocks all good in terms of the current value? That's what you've got to watch very, very carefully.
Yep.
But the other thing I think, which is terrific at the moment, is corporate actions, because the corporate balance sheets are good. They've got all sorts of cash building up. I mean, you know, everybody knows that roughly the company balance sheets, about 5 or 6% of them is in pure cash. And you're going to see some nice stock dividends or some basically share buybacks and stuff like that. And that's going to essentially underpin the market to some extent. Mm-hmm. And you're going to see this merger and acquisition stuff going on. And that's not going to go away, because all these cash-rich companies, for better or worse, are going to basically cannibalize each other. And that underpins values. That underpins values to some extent. Mm-hmm. So I'm less concerned about these stocks in the short run. But I think the long-term value issue, I think you've got to be careful about.
Now, let's talk a little bit about the, I guess it would be the divergence and the decoupling of the bond markets and the equity markets, because traditionally what you'll find is that, you know, bond yield of, let's just call the 10-year U.S. bond yield of, you know, under well, when I say traditionally, it can't really be that far back, because it just happened for the first time not too long ago, but under 2%, for example, is a sign of, uh-oh, what's going on? You know, a lot of bonds being bought, and that means it's, you know, kind of an anti-risk, you know, a risk-off kind of situation, more so that people are looking to stash the money at extraordinarily low prices. You know, interest rates, and at the same time, you have stocks going up. You know, what is happening there?
Well, I think fundamentally, I think you've got to look at the risk return trade offs here. In bonds, you don't get much upside because you only get your money back at the end of the day, and so they, particularly for sovereign bonds, are basically now very concerned about default risk. I think Jim Grant actually coined a lovely phrase. He said that basically bonds once gave you risk-free return. Now they give you return-free risk. And so there's a huge concern. There's a huge concern about that. That's the first thing. Mm-hmm. And that's not only from default risk. If you hold U.S. bonds or Eurozone bonds and the currency goes down, well, that's not particularly good either. So there's the two factors there. The second thing is, everybody says a low growth or a deflationary environment is bad. Now, it's bad for people in a certain situation. Companies actually sometimes benefit in that environment, at least in the short run, because if you don't have revenue growth, you don't have to invest.
Mm-hmm.
You actually build up cash. So basically, that cash can actually buy better things. So we're seeing that type of demand. And so that's actually leading to the equities decoupling. The other thing is, if you have interest rates of 2% and there are dividend stocks paying more than that, that's creating this bubble in high-yield dividend, also in the junk bond market. All of that is being underpinned to some degree by these low interest rates. So you're absolutely correct. You're going to see this decoupling for a while. And the other thing about the bonds, which is actually quite interesting, is don't forget the central banks of the emerging countries with capital surpluses are still buying U.S. treasuries. And in a perverse way, that's still underpinning some amount of the demand. Not all of them are buying, but there's still some demand. And the other thing, don't forget, there's a huge bid from the Federal Reserve. Because remember, they're still reinvesting their coupons and so forth in government bonds and mortgage-backed securities. All of that is underpinning the bond market yields at low level. And that's, if you look at the equity market, to me, the equity markets look to me like just a pure carry trade. Because if I can actually get money for free, you're basically going to buy them. And by the way, that's actually true of not only equities. You know what the best asset class last year was, Andrew? Have a guess.
I thought it was tips.
No, actually, it was actually vintage cars.
Ah.
Vintage cars.
I have to put that in my asset allocation model.
Absolutely. You've got to put that into, you know, basically, a Bugatti, a collector's Bugatti, went for $40 million.
Wow. Really?
A Ferrari from 64, I think it was, is they're talking about 30 million for it. Given you paid about 10 grand for it, you know, even allowing for the fact that it was 50 years ago, it ain't a bad investment.
Right, no, absolutely not.
So, and that's all coming about because interest rates are low. So you see this decoupling going on. At some point, though, it'll come back into line, but it's not going to come back anytime soon because of the stance of the central banks around the world.
Yeah. You know, how about this for a theory that, you know, if you're just on the outside and looking at just numbers, you know, you're looking at a spreadsheet and say, okay, let's look at the different markets around the world and let's see what has the greatest momentum, the greatest return, all that. And you look at this whole long list of last year's markets and you're seeing red, 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 horribly red. Oh my gosh, that's awful. You know, and then you come across the U.S. where the Dow is up and the other markets were just barely, you know, off, not too much. And you say, you know what, I'm going to put my money into the best performing market. See, if global investors that are just taking all this money that they have, whether it's banks through their trading or whether it's individuals, whatever, and they're saying, you know what, we're taking money out of the markets here and we're putting it over there for a couple of reasons. Number one, the dollar is low, so our dollar is worth, or our currency is worth a lot more, so we're going to buy it at a very low price. The second thing is, if the dollar does start moving up eventually, and eventually, I mean, it may not, but it could, well, I get that kind of backstop as well. It's kind of like the, in a weird way, the investing in Japan, you know, the yen keeps going up even though their markets go down, so you get a little protection there. And I think a lot of money is coming out of, or had come out of, worldwide investments in markets and into the U.S. And you could see that by this nonstop bid that every time the market is even close to red, there's a bid in it.
I think you're right. I think it's the problem of the way the investment management industry is structured. You have all this money trying to find a home, and they have these wonderful things called asset allocation models. And they've got to just keep moving things around. And to some extent, the momentum is driving that, simply because, as you say, the currency, the actual asset class, but more importantly, they're all benchmark-driven.
Right.
So they just have to beat the benchmark. It doesn't matter if the market's, you know, gone down 5, as long as they've only gone down 2. They're heroes. And so that's what's actually driving them, and the U.S. has certainly benefited from that. And also, I think the other thing about the U.S., which I always think is quite hilarious, that people don't factor into their thinking, if you want to be caught in a crisis, what do you want to be caught with? You always want to be caught with U.S. dollars because it served you very, very well, certainly for the last 50 or 60 years. So that's not going to go away. And, I mean, what was Saddam Hussein caught with in his cubbyhole when he was caught? He had basically 100 U.S. dollar bills in several stacks of several $100,000. And that's what's going to happen. And that's going to underpin the market because once you buy U.S. dollars, what are you going to buy? You're either going to buy equities or bonds. And both those markets are rallying.
Yeah. All right, so finally, let's just wrap up with this, a couple of points here. Now, is this European thing, it seems to me to be a very well-managed lately. I mean, they went through a gyration of problems, of leaking data and information. Finally, I think they caught on just to shut their mouths for a little while over there and stop talking as much. But at the same time, it seems to be very well managed in terms of the eventuality and trying to get people used to something and trying to, you know, find a way to make it an easy process. Because I think that right now everybody believes that, you know, Greece is a goner. And right now it's not affecting the markets, and that just spreads to more feeling that, hey, not much can go wrong here. Is there really going to be an effect from all of this problems, whether it's, you know, now or sometime in the future? I mean, what's the real cost of all this? This money spending and this incredible amount of debt? I mean, is it just disappears one day?
Look, I think at the end of the day, none of us know the answer definitively, but Europe will not end well. And you're absolutely correct. The smart thing they've done is they've stopped talking about it. Because this constant sort of news flow that they were creating was creating its own problems. They haven't quite shut it off entirely. But
no, they can't.
Got it.
They're addicted to it. They're like nuts.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I think you've got to look at Europe and say there's three or four pressure points. The treaty that they're talking about, this austerity, won't work, and they'll have problem implementing it. But again, that's not going to become apparent for 2 or 3 years. So the implementation issues are the next 6 months. But you know, even if you put this austerity into place, it's not going to really come out in terms of its economic effects for a while. So that's going to be slow. Greece is going to come off the edge at some point in time, but everybody sort of factored that in to some degree, so it doesn't matter. And you're going to see a couple of things, though, in Europe. All this sort of very nice sort of quietness trying to sneak things through, it will come apart because you've got the French elections, you've got the Greek elections, and I think Merkel's position in Germany is increasingly tenuous because she's got internal problems in Germany. So you've got to watch those things. So this could surface very quickly. And the channels for the rest of the world is pretty clear. And there's two channels that people should remember. Number one is Europe is a big trading nation or group. And that means the U.S.'s big trading partner is Europe. And Europe is also China's biggest trading partner.
Mm-hmm.
So in the real economy, you're going to have some effect. But the bigger effect, I think, will be on money markets, and we're starting to see that already. People forget that the European banking system has assets of $41 billion. Trillion dollars.
Trillion, yeah. I was thinking that wasn't much.
Yeah, no, 41 would be a breeze. It's $41 trillion. The U.S. banking system globally is $16 trillion. So it's 2.5 times. And they're deleveraging. And inescapable underlying all of that is we're still in this deleveraging. And what we've seen is a private sector and the corporates and the individuals basically all gradually deleverage. Now we're going to see the sovereign deleveraging and the financial institution deleveraging is going to continue. So we still have to go through that. And Europe is like sort of the epicenter of that, if you like, at the moment. But the epicenter will move. So that's not the issue. The issue is we still have the problems. We've bought a bit of time. And the game of extend and pretend continues.
And obviously, the euro just keeps on going up, and it's an amazing thing. They could sneeze, and the funny thing, the word draft or framework or potential or closer or these, by the way, we are now officially the early part of the week, we passed the time period when this thing was supposed to be resolved, and it just came and went again. And, you know, it's just like nobody really cares about those days. But anyway, we go on about this. I want to tell you, Das, my favorite new word or phrase that came into play, I guess early in the month, was when I read an article about Japan's debt, and it was quoted in quadrillions.
Yes, I have trouble with trillions. The quadrillions is beyond my mental arithmetic capacities.
Yep.
I just drop a few zeros off. But, you know, quadrillions, quadriplegics, you know, paraplegics, all sorts of things could become part of the financial vocabulary. But my favorite one now is, you know, I don't know whether you have this show in the United States, The Big Loser, where you have weight loss. I just think of the global economy as the big loser game, because all of us have to lose debt and so forth. It's a question of which one of us are going to succeed with the least damage and without heart failure.
I hear you. Das, he is the author of Extreme Money, also a prolific writer, a all-around great guy. He lives in down under in Australia and makes his way around to do all the different TV shows, et cetera, and very knowledgeable, obviously, with experience in the credit markets, actually trading and analyzing and really getting down and dirty with what is and what isn't. And hopefully one day, my hope is that like all these other fine books, his first book and this one were made into movies. My belief is that he is going to make a movie and have me as one of the starring roles.
Oh, Andrew, you're a shoo-in.
Right?
You're a shoo-in.
Yeah.
Right next to Brad Pitt and George Clooney.
That's what I thought.
Absolutely.
Oh, good. I didn't want to say
with
that.
With your looks, there's just no way that we could leave you out.
Das, you're a pleasure as always. Thanks for joining me. We'll make sure to hook up soon, and we'll also put some links on your site so people can find out where to find you and where to get your great information and your fine books.
Thanks, Andrew.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, that's Das for you. And being in his movie... You know, you never know. I mean, they're making some great movies out of some of the things that have happened over the last couple of years in the financial market. So we'll just have to see what happens there. But I will tell you that you really need to, if you haven't done so, check out all the things that Das writes about. Brilliant guy. Next week, we have some great guests as well. Some things lined up for you on the next several podcasts. If you have any questions, you know where to find me at askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. And of course, if you're interested in money management, just simply go to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Go over to where the little box there says the Disciplined Investor Managed Growth Strategy. We have that. We have our global allocations. If you want to see what it's all about, simply all you have to do is click on it. There's a 12, 13-minute little tutorial on there that tells you all about how we manage money. And if you want to get in this market or even out this market, if you want to be short, long, I mean, that's the kind of things that we do. We go both sides of the market. We have long positions and short positions. We'll do things like pick up the VIX. We'll pick up the natural gas, maybe short the euro currency transactions. It all depends on what's going on. Core is to find great stocks that can outperform and, of course, do our best to, to balance the portfolio when it comes to TDIMG. Anyway, we'll end on that note, and hopefully you have good information and good ammunition to hit the week running. I wish you a very profitable week. We'll see you soon. Thanks for joining me.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.